Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to be hosting this Courthouse Steps decision on Fold versus Palestine Liberation Organization. We're very pleased to welcome Arielle Davidson to this discussion today. Arielle is an associate at Holtzman Vogel, and a special thanks to Shiza Francis for moderating this discussion. Shiza is an associate at Schutz & Bowen, and prior to law school, she worked in the first Trump administration and for Governor Ron DeSantis. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speaker, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we may turn to the audience for questions, so if you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. And finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, Shiza, thanks so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thank you, Edith. So today we have Arielle, who's going to be discussing Feld v. PLO, which the court recently decided. And we have two buckets that we're going to be touching upon, the anti-terrorism litigation bucket and the very nerdy civil procedure bucket. So I'm going to give it over to Arielle to start, and then feel free to send in your audience questions, and we'll really take it in the direction of whatever the audience finds interesting or whatever stands out.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Shiza, and thanks for having me to the Federalist Society. So the question in Fold versus PLO is, it seems fairly basic, but I think it has a lot of implications within both, as you pointed out, Shiza, the Fed courts realm, and then also the anti-terrorism litigation space. So the question that the court was answering in Fold v. PLO was whether the Promoting Security and Justice for Victims of Terrorism Act violates the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment. And the case itself involved a group of 11 families that were either injured or lost a loved one in a Palestinian terror attack. And those attacks, or those involved in the attacks, were actually individuals who were paid by the PA or the PLO. So that is the component that involves the Palestinian Authority or the Palestine Liberation Organization. Fold, so the plaintiff whose name is on the case, his wife brought the suit, Miriam Fold. She is a widow. Her husband, Ari Fold, actually a native New Yorker, father of four, was standing outside a grocery store in 2018 in Judea. And he was stabbed to death by a Palestinian terrorist, 17-year-old. After he was stabbed, he actually chased his attacker and shot the terrorist before he was able to go into the grocery store and commit more acts of terror, which he said was his intention, because he was eventually taken, indicted, and imprisoned. And what made the attack even, you know, what added to the severity or the brutality of it was the fact that the terrorist who killed him is now on the payroll of the Palestinian Authority. So the Palestinian Authority has a program called Pay for Slay, and it's basically a constellation of laws that have been put into place by the Palestinian government that allow for any individual who engages in a terror attack or quote unquote martyrs himself, becomes a shaheed, to collect monthly stipends from the PA. And if they survive the terror attack, to actually get a government job after they are released from prison. And the longer you are in Israeli prison, the higher your stipend. If you are killed while completing the terror attack, your family is then eligible to receive your stipend. So you see that it's a formal institutionalized structure for funding terrorism within Palestinian society. And this is not Gaza and Hamas. This is the West Bank. This is the PA, the PLO, the ones that actually have set up shop on U.S. soil, which we'll talk about that, and have engaged with the United Nations. I refer to the PA and the PLO as terrorists in suits. I think that's 100% correct, although it is my opinion, so I'm biased. But that is the basis of the suit, was being able to bring the PA and the PLO into court. And I can talk a little bit, Shiza, if you think it'd be helpful, about the basis of jurisdiction and what the issues were in the case, or you can sort of guide us through it through questions. But I wanted to lay the framework so individuals understood why, what was specifically interesting or relevant or pertinent about the PA and the PLO in this case. And it's that the attackers who killed these American citizens are getting paid by the PA and the PLO and continue to get paid.
Yes. So in response, Congress passed a few rounds of legislation, and we were wondering if you could discuss how that gave victims of terror the opportunity to present their claims in federal courts.
Absolutely. So the PSJVTA, as Shiza pointed out, actually represents a long and tortured path on the part of Congress to try to get a statute that would allow U.S. courts to exercise jurisdiction over the PLO and the PA. So we have something in the early 90s, the Anti-Terrorism Act was passed. And this actually allowed, it was a civil statute that allowed for private litigants, victims of terrorism, to have their rights vindicated in court and to bring a case against those who provide material support to terrorists. But obviously there are jurisdictional limits attached to civil cases that you don't necessarily have in the criminal context. Obviously you have to satisfy personal jurisdiction in the criminal sense, but it's much more territorial based as opposed to a question of due process and fairness in the civil context. And so because even though the ATA was on the books, there was still a jurisdictional hurdle of being able to bring a group like the PLO and the PA into court for providing material support. So for instance, in a typical material support case, you would have, perhaps a bank based in New York that's conducting transactions for affiliates of Hezbollah. No jurisdictional issues there. That's a very common, actually, it's a very common ATA style case. In this instance, we're dealing with a group that, doesn't have as many contacts or as much footing on U.S. soil. And so how can we make it so that when they're brought into court, it's not violating due process, et cetera? And so Congress went back and forth over how to deal with this question. And what prompted it was there was initially a case brought into the Second Circuit called Waldman, very similar to Fuld, and actually they were combined eventually. But in that case in Waldman, the Second Circuit determined that the test for personal jurisdiction is the same under both the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment. And so if you recall, when it comes to the 14th Amendment, we deal with questions of general personal jurisdiction, whether a individual is or an entity is at home in the United States. And then you have specific personal jurisdiction, whether there is the minimum contacts test is satisfied. So these are questions that the court said emphatically, the PLO just did not satisfy either general personal jurisdiction or specific personal jurisdiction. Congress was a bit beside itself, and it actually passed what was called the Anti-Terrorism Clarification Act. So this is before the statute at issue right now. We're talking about the predecessor. The ATCA actually said that the ATA allows for a party to have consented to jurisdiction if after 120 days of the ATCA enactment, the defendant accepted certain forms of aid from the United States or maintained an office in the United States. The PLO and the PA did both. And at the time, they shut their offices. They were like, we don't want to be subjected to the jurisdiction of U.S. courts. We're shutting our offices down. And so again, when the case came before the Second Circuit, they still refused to exercise jurisdiction because the PLO and the PA had denied assistance and shuttered their offices. And so in response, Congress passed the PSJVTA, which is the statute at issue here. And the PSJVTA was crafted with the knowledge of what would trigger, quote unquote, the Second Circuit to say no. So the PSJVTA provides two bases of jurisdiction. The first is if you're making payments directly or indirectly to a terrorist that either injures or kills a U.S. national, or if you pay the terrorist family members. So that's the whole pay for slave program I opened up with. And then, or if you maintain or establish any office, headquarter, premises, or facility or establishments in the United States, or conduct any other activity that's not exempted under the UN. What made the PSJVTA even narrower is that it actually calls out the PLO and the PA by name. So this is not a jurisdictional statute that applies to all non-sovereign organizations operating abroad that might fund terrorism. This applies specifically to the PLO and the PA. So you see the degree of particularity and that Congress had when it designed this statute. And so I think when we get into the opinion, I'll talk about why that's relevant, but effectively that's what made it so, I think the courts, at least the Supreme Court, much more forgiving that this is not a wide in scope statute. It's very narrow. It's very particularized to the PLO and the PA. So going back to that case, Waldman, eventually the Waldman plaintiffs filed for cert petition after the PSJVTA came into existence, and the Supreme Court remanded, sent it back to the Second Circuit for review. Fold was combined with Waldman, and there is actually another Second Circuit decision, which we can talk about later on. But again, the Second Circuit said, we can't exercise jurisdiction here because the PSJVTA as written is unconstitutional because it violates the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment. And Judge Menasche had a dissent from en banc that was excellent, that went into quite a bit of detail about why the Second Circuit's original decision was incorrect. And the Supreme Court actually relied a decent amount on it. So we can talk a bit about that as well. But that gives you a little bit of the procedural history, as well as sort of the laws that came that preceded the PSJVTA, namely the Anti-Terrorism Act, the ATA, followed by the ATCA, and then finally the PSJVTA, which is the statute we're dealing with today.
Yes. And these cases go on for a very long time. That jury trial in that first case was the jury verdict came in 2015, and this case is still ongoing. We do have one question that's an easy one to answer. Yes, the PLO and PA were the defendants in the case, so they are actively involved in the participation and litigation and defending this case. So essentially, the Supreme Court held that the Fifth Amendment was not violated. The Fifth Amendment due process clause was not violated because its outer limits are broader than what is under the 14th Amendment. So for our Fed Court civil procedure listeners, can you just touch upon that a little bit and where you see the clarity in the opinion, if there is some, if there isn't, and where this kind of jurisdictional question will go in the future?
Yeah, it's a very interesting opinion, because when you and I had prepped for this conversation, Shizzo, we talked about how it was sort of definition by exclusion. Like the Supreme Court sort of dropped this bomb on us about the relationship between the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment, but then doesn't give us any more information. So it effectively, in SCOTUS's opinion, they say the language of the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment are roughly the same, but they don't mean the same thing. Because the state and the federal government occupy different sovereign spheres. And so they don't want to apply the same test that we use for the 14th Amendment, namely the minimum contacts test. That standard, we're not going to read that into the Fifth Amendment. And part of their reasoning, which I think is very straightforward, is look, the 14th Amendment dealt with interstate federalist concerns, namely, you know, states don't want their citizens being dragged into court in other states if that state court is the one to have jurisdiction. So there's, you know, the 14th Amendment was about balancing state power concerns. You don't have those same concerns when it comes to the Fifth Amendment. And so that's why the restrictions that are applied in the 14th Amendment are improper for the purposes of the Fifth Amendment. What was interesting in Fold is that the plaintiffs actually argued that there was no restrictions on Fifth Amendment federal jurisdiction. The court rejected that position, but they didn't really say anything beyond. They didn't attempt to establish what test should apply. So even though they rejected importing the minimum contacts test for the purposes of the 14th Amendment, for the purposes of the Fifth Amendment, they don't actually tell us what are the boundaries or what are the confines of Fifth Amendment jurisdiction. And so all they really held, and it's a pretty narrow holding in that sense, is that a statute such as the PSJVTA that, quote, ties federal jurisdiction to conduct closely related to the United States that implicates foreign policy concerns is constitutional. So they don't really define the limits of jurisdiction under the Fifth Amendment. What was interesting is that Thomas wrote a concurrence, and he actually said that the Fifth Amendment plays no limits on jurisdictions of the federal courts. What makes this case interesting is that, again, it's a definition by exclusion. We know we're attempting to define the bounds of Fifth Amendment, of jurisdiction under the Fifth Amendment by saying what it isn't. And that can be a longer process. And so what I would be curious about is if further opinions down the road come down, if they don't just continue to sort of chip away at a framework by continuing to do a sort of definition by exclusion approach, i.e. we're not going to spell out a test, we're just going to tell you what it's not. I think that sometimes can make litigation both easier and harder, right? Because harder in the sense you don't really know what the rule is, but easier is that you can sort of craft one and attempt to present it to the courts as one possible avenue that comports with due process under the Fifth Amendment. So this case is very meaningful, but then I think it kind of stops short of giving us a real framework for understanding what the limits are of jurisdiction under the Fifth Amendment. I thought Judge Menasche made a very interesting point, and that was sort of pithy in his denial. He said, since foreign states are not generally subject to the due process clause, if the PA and the PLO were recognized tomorrow, like if they were, they would not, then the PSJVTA would be perfectly constitutional. And that's funny because that's the position of the PA and the PLO anyways, that they are sovereigns. And so if they were, we wouldn't even be conducting this due process analysis. So there's a bit of having your cake and eating it too here as well on the part of the defendants. But I think Judge Menasche does a nice job of sort of crystallizing that in his denial or his dissent.
Yes. And the court at the end of the opinion really explicitly said we don't need to touch upon the issue because even under these circumstances, the 14th Amendment heightened standard is met. So we don't need to really think about that lower standard, which again, I think begs the question of which case would actually present a question like squarely to the court. I want to touch a little bit about Justice Thomas's concurring opinion. And he really touches on what his definition of the deprivation of due process is versus the historical understanding. And he has the law of the land view that the due process clause don't limit the legislature. They limit the executive and to a certain extent, the judicial branch. So if you could just comment a little bit about how that really kind of comports with foreign policy and how it's done in the anti-terrorism litigation space.
Yeah, so yeah. This is an instance of a specific federal jurisdictional statute that is designed to give the federal courts authority when they otherwise may not have it. And that's perfectly in line with the foreign affairs powers that the founders envisioned for both Congress and the executive. And so this is not outside the realm of what would be reasonable. And I think that, it is interesting. Again, we had talked about this earlier. It is interesting that the court, you know, still recognizes that even if the 14th Amendment were the standard for determining whether the 14th Amendment tests were the standard for determining whether due process has been satisfied, it's still, those standards still would have been met. I do think it's interesting. It's a little bit of a equivocation on the part of the court. So I appreciated that Thomas kind of just went full throttle in his concurrence and ignored all of that. But there is a little bit of equivocation, I think, or maybe even slight hesitation on the part of SCOTUS That being said, you know, we talked about, well, what does this mean for the ATA space? This is a pretty big deal for the ATA space for a few reasons. One, you know, I can't tell you the number of plaintiffs that have attempted to bring cases against the PLO and the PA and have had their cases tossed out on the basis of personal jurisdiction. So putting aside sort of the merits, ATA cases, all there's a lot of debate over the merits of whether material support has been satisfied through various different tests under Halverson v. Welch, et cetera. And we could do a whole segment on that. That's the merits of the case. And to be frank, you know, Fuld, those litigants have a long road ahead of them because this is just the threshold question of whether personal jurisdiction is satisfied. They've got to get to now into the merits of their ATA case, which is a long, road. And as you've pointed out, this litigation takes a very long time. It's particularly true in the ATA context and in the FSIA context, if you, you know, for instance, sue Iran. So in terms of, you know, what it means for ATA litigation, the first is that it helps a lot of victims of America, a lot of American victims of terrorism who otherwise wouldn't be able to get the PLO and the PA into court. It also, you know, I think opens the door for potential litigation against the PA and the PLO after October 7. And the reason I say that, so, you know, I represent a group of October 7 victims in various cases, ATA cases right now. And, you know, one of the things that obviously is relevant is whether, you know, an organization has provided material support to those who engaged in acts of terrorism. And in the case of October 7, what's interesting about the PLO and the PA is that because they've institutionalized their pay for slave program, we know, and they actually advertise it. This is what's even crazier. They advertise the number of individuals they're paying, and they do it proudly because to them, this is like a form of welfare. So they will advertise that the number of individuals that they're paying has increased. So after October 7, the PLO and the PA increased the number of prisoners they were paying by 70%. Now, the economy in the West Bank is crippled, declining, in really rough shape. But they managed to scrape together some money, aka foreign aid, to pay the individuals that are in prison for killing Jews. And so they advertise that they increase the number of prisoners that they're paying by 70%. What does that mean? It means after October 7, there were individuals who partook in October 7 that the PA and the PLO is rewarding. So I actually see an opportunity here for victims of October 7 to go after the PLO and the PA, which sounds unusual because we know Hamas and Palestinian civilians from Gaza carried out October 7. But now there's this sort of interesting wrinkle here of possibly a new frontier of litigation for October 7 victims, particularly because we have, you know, the numbers to show for it because the PLO and the PA are so brazen in their pay for slave program. So I think post October 7, there are very particular implications. And then the last point I'll make is it just shows that the respectability of the PA and the PLO could not be at a lower point. You know, I think they've tried to advertise themselves as the potential peace partner and sort of as a foil to Hamas. And you just see that Congress and now the Supreme Court aren't buying it insofar as, you know, they should be dragged into court for terrorism related offenses. And that's because they fund terrorism. And so the veneer of respectability has so deeply eroded that's the most critical case relating to them is one that says, yeah, actually you guys fund terrorism.
Yes. And along those lines, the PSJVTA, we have a question, would that extend to other entities or is that really just limited by its text to the PLO? And
it's just limited by its text, the PLO and the PA, which is why it was so. And I think, again, this goes to why the SCOTUS was so willing to read it as constitutional because it was so narrow in its focus. It wasn't overbroad in any way. And it also really represented the culmination of Congress's efforts to bring the PLO and the PA into court because PLO and PA terrorism, for those who don't realize, it's been going on for decades, since the 1970s, since the PA and the PLO were founded. They have funded terrorism, particularly against Americans, for a very long time. There's actually a particular case, Klinghoffer, in the 80s, where, you know, there was an American on a cruise ship. He was wheelchair bound, and terrorists funded by the PLO actually asked him if he was American before they threw him overboard. And they were targeting him because he was an American. And his case also came into U.S. courts. So this is something that has really, really bothered Congress for a long time. And I think SCOTUS knew that.
I think the Chief Justice touched upon it in his opinion that there should be some protection for U.S. citizens that that has some extraterritorial limits. And in the context of terrorism, it's one of them. It's in like the broader bucket of intentional torts when it comes to being subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. We have one more question along the foreign policy route, and then we can switch back our gears. So how in practice would these litigants actually collect damages? Or is this really just a symbolic victory that they get in a U.S. court?
That's a really interesting question. So in the case of, if you're dealing with, I guess I'll insert in two parts, general ATA litigation, it really depends on the defendant. If you're dealing with a non-state actor, let's say like a charity, the ideal would be, you know, potentially that the charity either shuts down, or there are instances in which a charity might come to the attention of DOJ and it may be prosecuted under criminal statute. So there's an analogous criminal statute from which the civil statute was born, 18 USC 2339B, that deals with material support. And that's the criminal statute that would allow for individuals to be prosecuted. So there's a possibility, and we see this happen in the ATA space quite a bit, where you have, you know, a certain defendant is brought to the attention of DOJ, and then there's prosecutorial measures that are taken against that defendant. And what's interesting, under 2339B, you can actually be prosecuted for attempting to provide material support. And the standard for material support in the criminal context is a bit lower than the civil one. Shiza and I talked about this. The criminal context, you basically just have to show that the defendant was providing material support to an FTO. There's no knowledge requirement that actually has to tie the defendant to the act that took place. It's just, if you give money to a member of Hamas, you have been deemed to have provided material support to Hamas. And then if someone's injured by Hamas, you can be held accountable. So that's how the criminal statute works. And you, in terms of collecting in other instances where it's not an American-based entity, like a charity, for instance, or an individual in the United States, you know, in the case of, let's say you were suing like a non-sovereign entity, like the PA or the PLO, it's possible you could get their assets frozen and then try to collect on any assets they have in the United States. That's very hard. We see it in the FSIA context. So the PLO and the PA can't be sued under the FSIA because they're not sovereigns.
Can we take a pause and explain what the foreign sovereign immunity
is? Yes. Okay. So this is, you asked like a loaded question. How do you collect? And it's a good one. But the reason I bring up the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act is because there are exceptions to when you can sue sovereigns. So for instance, a state sponsor of terror like Iran gets sued a decent amount because there are victims of terrorism that have been sponsored by Iran. And so the FSIA says sovereigns are immune unless they satisfy certain exceptions, like a commercial activity exception, or in this case, the terrorism exception. So Iran will be brought into court and, you know, they'll be sued and there may be a default judgment. That's often what happens. And then if there's a default judgment, then it's on the plaintiffs to try to find assets to execute. And that's really hard, actually, because of sanctions. There aren't as many assets in the United States, and they just have fewer, there are fewer things to seize and to liquidate. And so what ends up happening in that case is plaintiffs will have to go into court and have the decision actually revived, basically like every 10 or 11 years. So there are certain decisions that are outstanding in the DC circuit, for instance. If you go on the docket, you'll find that those decisions have had to be revived like two or three times because the plaintiffs just can't find assets to collect on. So it's actually really hard when you sue rogue sovereign states like Iran. Now you're asking about PLO and PA. It can even be harder, right? Because they're not sovereign states. So there's even less of a formal institutional framework for, you know, locating their assets because they're not a sovereign. So there is some symbolism tied to it. But there's a lot of, you know, foreign policy considerations that might come into play, and you may possibly be able to get their assets frozen. You may be able to get the U.S. government involved in some way, and through some collaboration with the state or DOJ. So there are other avenues. It's just a bit unconventional. And, you know, as the questioner points out, there is a symbolism attached to it. But yeah, I mean, you can do your best to sort of bankrupt these organizations as much as possible by going after the assets that you can locate.
And again, Justice Thomas also touched upon this a little bit in his concurrence as to why courts should be hesitant to really have any limits under the Fifth Amendment, because these kind of actions are used as a bargaining chip in the broader foreign policy debate. Let's say you want to end the conflict. Well, one of the bargaining points could be that you have to pay the judgment, all of these outstanding judgments from United States courts, which I think was a good point that he,
super salient. Yeah. Because it goes to the fact that it's even though this is a civil suit with private litigants, the foreign affairs powers is still very much implicated. And so it's, as you point out, it's highly relevant.
Yes, for sure. And going back again to the Fed Courts issue about it a little bit. So one other, I think, critique that could be had of congressional legislation in this kind of space is that sometimes if it's the intent of the legislature or not, it really changes the outcome of pending litigation, maybe in one or two cases. And interestingly, the Chief Justice wrote this opinion that was 9-0, but he dissented in a 7-2 opinion called Bank Markazi, where he essentially said that Congress crossed the line and infringed on the judicial power by essentially changing the law to direct an outcome in a case involving terrorism. So can you just comment on that space a little bit and how you see that role fitting in, even though practically it looks like the Chief Justice has abandoned it and there's been a lot of turnaround in the court. So maybe this is just going to be sort of a blip for the Chief, and it will be not an issue going forward.
Yeah. I think so, without getting into the weeds on Bank Markazi, but I think it's a very interesting point you make. Two things I'd be curious about. One is I wonder if with this type of, when Roberts wrote this opinion, if he felt from the get-go that the Second Circuit had gotten it wrong repeatedly. And I think if you believe that the initial opinion that launched this, so with the first Waldman opinion, if you believe that the Second Circuit's just been getting it wrong repeatedly and Congress has been very accommodating, then that sort of changes the framework, because it's not really that Congress is being sort of malicious or, you know, attempting to target an individual or an entity. It's just that they're trying to get their work done and they're getting thwarted by the courts. And now SCOTUS finally has the chance to be decisive about it. That's sort of how I see it, is more that from my take on how Roberts can hold two opinions at the same time is that in this case, I think he must have felt to some degree that the initial opinions that had been issued by the Second Circuit like 10 years ago with regards to Waldman were wrong. That when they dealt with whether it was the ATCA or the ATA more generally, that they were just incorrect. Now, I can't read the mind of Roberts, but that would be how I would hold both of those opinions at the same time. I also think, again, going back to the idea that this is extremely narrow opinion. It's narrow in two ways. It's narrow because it just deals with a statute that targets exclusively the PAA and the PLO. And it's also narrow because, as we talked about, it doesn't really define the limits of the Fifth. It doesn't give us a test or a standard or a rule for determining whether the Fifth Amendment's due process clause has been satisfied. So I think that, again, you know, I don't think Robert sees this opinion as that sweeping. The way in which it is sweeping, not in a Fed court sense, but an ATA sense, is that it shows the ethos of the court. Where the court is now, as we mentioned earlier, is that you should and can, you can and should be able to bring the PA and the PLO into court, and that anti-terrorism litigation is a real tool in a toolkit held by Congress and the executive for dealing with foreign terrorism. That's the takeaway I got from this. As you pointed out, when in Thomas's concurrence, but that's what I got from this opinion as well, is that this, even though this is private litigation, this is regarded as a very important tool of deterrence for dealing with international terrorism against American victims. And so that to me is a big, big takeaway in terms of how the court understands ATA litigation. This is not just your standard torts issue, but this is something that, you know, the SCOTUS feels very strongly that the federal government is implicated in.
Yeah. Along the lines of that, switching gears back to the Fed Courts question, I've had different versions of this question of what the difference between the 14th and 15th and the Fifth Amendment, even though the words are textually similar, has in other areas of the law. And I know it was a particular concern of Justice Barrett and some of the other justices during oral arguments. They referenced, for example, Judge Ho's concurring opinion in a similar case that, you know, warned the court to be very hesitant to read these two clauses differently because that has implications for incorporation. Some folks are asking, how is this different in the immigration context? So with knowing that this is a very limited opinion that doesn't say much, if you feel comfortable speculating as to how this will impact other areas of the law, we'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so it's actually, that's a very good question. And you and I talked about this. And so I'm going to give my opinion, but I also want you to feel free to do so as well, because I'm sure you also have thought about this. Because you were, when we first started talking, you were intrigued by the Fed Courts element of this case. And I kind of came into it with, you know, very, very intrigued by, because I do anti-terrorism litigation. So this was like a very big day for us in the ATA world. Yeah, I mean, the implications of it to me are not obvious, because I think you would, if Thomas's concurrence had been the opinion of the court, I think we would be operating in a very different world. Do I think that we're waking up now in a completely different space? Not really, unfortunately and unfortunately, only because, as I said before, it doesn't seem to me that there's not a lot of meat to work with here. Part of that is because Roberts actually conducted the 14th Amendment analysis on the PLO and the PA in order to say, even if you disagree with our holding, the 14th Amendment is still satisfied. So in my mind, it's not clear to me what the implications are going to be outside the foreign affairs space. And there's also a line here under the Fifth Amendment, a quote, more flexible jurisdictional inquiry is permitted commensurate with the federal government's broader sovereign authority. And so it's not, again, to me, this is very generalist language that doesn't really imply to me other spaces where it's going to be relevant or problematic, let's say, because I think it's probably going to introduce more problems than help, because the language is so broad and ambiguous. Like, this is the power of the federal courts. Okay. But Shiza, go, I mean, if you have ideas about where you see this playing out elsewhere, feel free to share. I think at this point, the opinion is way too, it's both very limited and also ambiguous in its language as to where else it might apply. And the court doesn't even opine. Like, the court doesn't even give us an idea of where else this could be applicable. But if you're a creative litigator, that might be actually really kind of great, because you can fill in the gaps.
Yes. So I encourage everyone to read the Fifth Circuit opinion. Douglas v. I cannot say this litigant's name, so I'm not going to attempt. But it's, the citation is 46 F 4th 226. Essentially, there were a lot of concurrences and differences of opinion. The court below held that the standard for the due process standard for both the Fifth and 14th Amendment were the same, which is obviously not what the court held in this case. But Judge Ho's concurrence said that if we really do take this linguistic drift theory seriously, that because these clauses were ratified at different times, that they have somewhat different meanings, then one of the implications of that would definitely be the incorporation doctrine, which would definitely throw some upheaval into constitutional law as we know it, for sure, because we'll have to do a different historical analysis for you know, claims against the federal government infringing on your rights under the Bill of Rights and claims against the states doing it. So I think that my big takeaway was that there's lots of warnings in different directions to keep this very limited. And I think the court itself wants to do that too. Even in oral arguments, really, everyone was sort of on the same page that this is allowable under the Fifth Amendment, but we need to find a rule. And I think this is what the court is struggling with too. Justice Gorsuch in particular, discussed some cases, that Justice Story, wrote, authored, and how they would potentially have to be overruled. And, you know, there's always like the hesitation on Twitter, like, is this the end of international shoe? I don't think it is. Or if it was, I would probably have to quit being a lawyer because I wouldn't know what to do.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. But I think that my general takeaway and what we'll see is that this will probably continue to be very limited in the future because it's just so much simpler and opens a lot of it's just so much simpler to leave it as it is now, but we'll see what the court does. This is kind of in the broader sphere of the court figuring out how rights apply in with a purely originalist understanding of things. We've kind of like, we've gotten across the finish line of, okay, you generally have to do originalist interpretation and the context and text and history really matter to what does that mean in practice? And there are interesting questions, technical questions that come up when you do that kind of analysis, and also just the broader question of whether courts should be doing that kind of analysis.
Well, it's hard because originalist interpretation is kind of at odds with purposivism, right? So what SCOTUS was getting at was really sort of, and Judge Ho is a purposivist interpretation of the distinction between the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment, right? Because what was the purpose of each? That's not originalism, right? Originalism, as we understand it, is public meaning originalism. So how was this statute understood at the time it was enacted? I guess originalism is more about how is the Constitution in particular, not statute, but how is the Constitution understood when it was enacted? And that in and of itself is, you know, there may be times where purposivism and originalism overlap, i.e. in the sense that the public understands the purpose of the particular provision of the Constitution. And so therefore the understanding, the original public meaning merges with the purpose of the actual provision, but that's not always the case. And so we're kind of in an interesting world too now where this is not really like an originalist opinion in that way. And so I think to your point, it's going to lend for some very interesting interpretations because it's not often that you'll see courts, at least, GOP appointed judges engaging in necessarily purposivism explicitly. But I think there's a bit of that going on here. And I do think that the dicta will be relevant as lower courts have been given this directive. The dicta is going to be helpful. The dicta is the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment aren't the same thing. Do what you want with it. I think we're going to see very interesting tests come out of different circuits. We're 100% going to see this come up again in SCOTUS. They've just sort of kicked the can down the road a little bit, but I do think we're going to see circuits come up with interesting creative tests as a result of this.
And I think one other area where this is going to manifest in the international space is in the commercial litigation space and in the arbitration space. The court said we're not commenting on anything where parties have consented to jurisdiction, but that's also a big, you know, what if there are treaties around enforcing arbitration agreements that have less of the moral valence than does acts of terror against American citizens. Yeah, where we're going to have to figure out maybe it is really unfair for this defendant who is a foreign entity to be hailed into this court under this law or under this treaty. We have 10 more minutes, so if anyone else has any questions, we'd be happy to chat with those as well. Do you, and if you don't, do you have any closing thoughts wrapping up about I think we covered a lot of it about how you see this fitting into the broader international space.
I think we covered everything. I will say, like, it was good to be able to cover a little bit of the intricacies of pay-for-slay, so people can kind of realize the degree to which the PLO and the PA, you know, we're not just dragging quasi sovereigns into court, we're dragging terrorism sponsors into court. And that's an interesting, again, that's, this really chips away at the respectability of the PLO and the PA if we're talking about sort of the foreign affairs implications of this decision.
And so what is next for these litigants after the SCOTUS win?
Yeah, that's a great question. Now it's going to be remanded. It's going back down to the lower courts. And there now the real fight begins. Although I wouldn't say that, because I actually was on a podcast last week with Miriam Fuld. And, you know, she's been fighting, as you pointed out, she's been fighting for quite some time. So her husband was killed in 2018. So this has been going on for quite some time. And that has been that jurisdictional fight was a fight in and of itself. But now the next step of work begins, which is, you know, showing the merits of the case. And, you know, she has evidence that shows that the individual who killed her husband is or was in fact receiving payments. He actually was released during he was released during the October 7 negotiations to have hostages released when Israel was forced to release prisoners. So her husband's murderer is now free. But prior to that, there is evidence that he was receiving payment from the PA after killing her husband. So, you know, I think this is where a lot of the hard work and a lot of the activity in the ATA space takes place, is on the merits. Like, she's going to have to show there a certain knowledge requirement was established, which I think will be fairly straightforward. And, you know, I'm not her attorney, so won't comment on the case itself, but it's a strong case, and I think it'll be an important one to follow.
Okay, great. I think this seems like a great point to wrap up. If there are no more questions, I will throw it back to FedSoc. Thank you, Ariel, for giving us your time, and I hope everyone who's participated has enjoyed this.
Thank you, Shiza. Thank you.
Yeah. And just to echo that, on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Ariel for speaking with us today about this decision, and to Shiza for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise. And thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and other upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.